It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a state lawmaker about his new proposed bill that would create a voluntary 7-day work week in Wisconsin.
Before that, we're talking to the sheriff of Milwaukee County, David A. Clark Jr., about early release programs in Wisconsin prisons. He wrote an opinion piece last week coming out against these programs.
Sheriff Clark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
Well, one of the arguments that's been winning over people to these early release programs is that they can save the community, local government, state government some money. Why don't you buy that?
Well, first of all, you know, there's two sides to many of these issues. And what I'm seeing lately is that we're only hearing one side. And I think that some of the language being used in terms of these early release programs, you know, they throw out cost savings, they throw out it improves public safety, but I haven't seen any empirical evidence evaluated by a third party using rigorous academic standards that verify these self-proclaimed success stories. I think these are more about satisfying a predetermined soft-on-crime agenda rather than promoting good public policy, and I say that because I don't think I've ever heard of an inmate program that has failed, and as you know, that's a statistical improbability.
And you think this is more wishful thinking than evidence-based?
Well, you know, you mentioned the cost savings. I think there's a shell game going on here because this early release program that was written about that I opined on had indicated that the costs are being shifted from incarceration onto probation and parole. And that's the shell game I'm talking about. That's not a cost saving, just moving money around. And now what you're doing, I believe, you're taking probation and parole agents who already have unmanageable caseloads, and you're overburdening them as well. So the thing that I find disappointing in this is that law enforcement executives have turned over the responsibility of fighting crime and strategies, effective strategies to do that, to intellectual elites in universities. Now, the problem I have with that is many of these individuals, they live in a cocoon. Devoid of any of the realities of urban ghetto life. And they mainly only read about what's going on out here. And I'm talking about myself, a 35-year law enforcement veteran, urban policing, and I'm talking about the cop on the street. A lot of what's being offered is theoretical knowledge. There's nothing wrong with testing these theories, but that's really all they are. And the cops who have to apply these untested theories and the public that ends up on the receiving end of these experiments, and many of them do turn into a disaster, but they pay the heaviest price, and that's why I call this social engineering, and that's what upsets me the most. The petri dish for these theories and experiments has become the urban neighborhood, and what I find, and I've mentioned this too, I find this immoral because they're using human subjects as, you know, in their lab experiments, and I've done graduate-level work. I attended graduate school at the United States Naval Academy post-graduate school, and when I did my thesis, one of the things that we had to sign off on is that we didn't use human subjects in our thesis, and that's kind of what's going on here. So all I'm really saying is I think it's time to start to poke and start to prod and peel the layers back on some of these social engineering experiments and find out exactly, you know, what's going on. They claim and they self-proclaimed success and so on and so forth. Maybe it's there, but I'm not seeing it. Just because somebody tells me these things work, I don't think is enough to, at least for my graduate level research, you can't just make the claim. You have to show your work, and I'm just not seeing it.
And your big worry, and one of the big objections to these early release programs, is that we might release somebody too soon. They'll create a danger in their community, maybe commit future crimes if we let the wrong people out early. Is that the bottom line worry that you have about this?
Well, that's a hypothesis I would offer, and that's all I'm doing here is offering a counter hypothesis here, because like I said, when these experiments fail, and they do. We hear about them in the news stories of some person with a long criminal history that finally goes out and does the worst possible act that can be done, and that's to take a human life. And then we see this arrest record that's in, you know, as long as my arm, and I got a 36 inch sleeve length. And we see time and time again of leniency, a second chance, and a third chance, and a fourth chance, and of inmate programming. And I would challenge some of these claims that are made out of these early release programs. I would say, how many of the people that you're talking about in your claim of success have had previous attempts at inmate programming, have had previous alcohol and drug addiction counseling and treatment, on and on and on? And I'm all for helping people, but I'm also for inserting punishment in its rightful place in corrections and in policing, because we know that if you want a certain behavior, you reward that behavior. And if you don't want a certain behavior, you punish that behavior so you get less of it. So what we do is we take the career criminal, the recidivist, he gets arrested, and we don't punish him for what he did. And I'm not talking about draconian methods, but I mean, we don't punish him. We reward him with job training, with alcohol and drug treatment. Not that we shouldn't do that, but we're sending the message to that person is, you know what, you did something you shouldn't have done, and instead of teaching you a lesson so that you don't do that again, we're going to reward you with these things. So we're actually, you know, having the opposite effect on the mind of the criminal, who says, you know what, I can keep doing this, and what's going to happen is they're going to give me a second chance. I'm going to get to serve my time in the community with these, you know, these community corrections, on and on and on. And that's what their mind is processing, that crime, in fact, does pay.
Well, as I understand, at least some of the programs, like the one, I think it was in Racine, they're selecting inmates, nobody with, no sex offenders, no one with violent armed crimes in their background. They're doing a six-month substance program, and the offender has to have some kind of success in that program before they let them out. Does that give some room for, you know, measuring this and letting the right people out, and maybe the ones who fail stay in prison? Is that so bad?
It's not a matter of if it's so bad. I would say if you just say we're not using sex offenders, and again, that's some of that language that they use so that, oh, no sex offenders, well, then you're not worried about it. That still leaves a lot of crimes that are included in this program. Even if you take out sex offenders and homicidal and gun charges, that still leaves burglars, that still leaves car thieves, that still leaves people who rob, you know, and I can go on, theft, you know, on and on and on. It still leaves a lot of people in that population. So I say that at least while a criminal is locked up, that neighbor that they're removed from gets a respite from the violence, the chaos, the pain and suffering that law-abiding people, many times women and children, have to endure while this individual's out on the street. Now, one of the problems that I have with this, and I believe it's a misguided approach, is that the neighborhoods that they're putting these individuals back into in the early release, Rob, they don't have the support structures in place or necessary for this individual to thrive. There are no jobs in these urban centers. We all know that. You look at the black unemployment rate in Milwaukee. There are no jobs to go back to. There is no family structure, and there's no caring attachment and other support type apparatus that this individual can then, you know, an infrastructure that this individual can latch onto and then springboard from there. So they're taking this individual and they're putting them back into this chaotic, dysfunctional environment, and they think with 6 months of treatment that this person's going to thrive. Rob, I wish human behavior worked that way. I wish it were that easy, but the reality is that it's not.
Is there a worry that if we don't try to do a program like this, give an incentive for inmates to give out, we're basically just writing them off forever?
No, we're not writing them off forever. First of all, you got to take this thing individually. So you have to look at these individuals, and they claim they're looking at them individually, but I'd look at the criminal history. And if this person is, let's say, 26 years old and has, you know, 15, 17, 18 arrests on their record, that is going to decrease the chance that a program like this is going to work. So I would expect that they would be a little more selective and not to say, well, it doesn't include sex offenders. And what I think should be done is we take that money, Rob, that we're spending after criminal behavior becomes ingrained and it becomes a lifestyle. I think we take that money and we apply it toward the front end on youth programs and on younger people before criminal behavior becomes a lifestyle, I think we're going to have, it'll be money well spent then after it becomes ingrained. Because once it becomes ingrained, like many of these individuals, it is, or it has become ingrained, it's more difficult to reverse. So we're taking these millions of dollars to an individual, and then we're saying, well, we're providing, you know, a GED program and alcohol and drug. Why don't we spend the money on the front end with youth programs before they start using drugs? We're going to have a better chance at getting them or keeping them off them to begin with. Not everybody, but keeping them off to begin with, which is a lot easier than trying to reverse this thing early on. So I think what we need to look at, and I just want this whole discussion, I want everybody to be, instead of just saying, hey, we're trying this thing and it's working, well, wait a minute, maybe it is, but I don't think it is. I think I can prove that. Why don't we have this honest debate about who's worth this type of risk? Because when they claim that the people who've gone through their six-month program, and it takes a longer time than that to clean somebody out who's addicted to drugs and alcohol anyway, but let's say we without the program, 20% of the inmates who are released end up being rearrested, and with the program, 21%. I would say, well, that's such a minuscule result that is that worth, from a cost-benefit perspective, is that worth the millions of dollars that we're spending? And then is that worth putting that individual, that's, you know, with a 6% difference there, back into, like I said, these already stressed communities to reoffend on women, children, on people who, you know, are just trying to live somewhat of a normal life? So I don't think we're being selective enough, and I really don't think we're being honest in terms of the assessment of these programs.
Sheriff Clark, thanks a lot for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Rob, it's always my pleasure.
That was David Clark Jr., Milwaukee County Sheriff.
Up next, we'll hear from a state lawmaker who drafted a bill that would create a voluntary 7-day work week in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Later in the hour, it's Wisconsin Life, and we'll talk about what things make us uniquely Midwestern.
First, according to current Wisconsin state law, employers are required to give employees 24 consecutive hours off every 7 days.
Two state lawmakers want to change that. Senator Glenn Grothman of West Bend and Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam co-authored a bill making it possible to work a 7-day work week. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce is advocating for that legislation. The bill has been opposed by Democrats, who are worried the change could allow employers to force their workers to work more hours. Co-author Representative Mark Bourne is here with us now. Representative Bourne, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us something about why you and Senator Grothman decided to introduce this bill now?
Sure, yeah. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, as you said, had been promoting the bill, and they presented it, the idea to me, and I took a look at it and thought it was something that made sense to move forward with. I've certainly been focused in the last year, and and most of the assembly has been on things like this. Part of our Write the Rules thing that's been going on focuses on stuff like this, trying to bring state rules or laws in line more with federal or what other states are doing, so that our businesses and in this case, employees also can compete on the same playing field as other states do. So this seemed like one that made sense to move forward at this time.
Well, let's get some context. Why was the Wisconsin law that requires 24 hours of time off in every 7-day work period originally created?
Well, I don't know the full history on it, but what this law is it's specific to one segment of Wisconsin employees. It's for folks that work in factories or mercantile establishments. So not all Wisconsin employees fall under this. It's a very specific group. So, of course, people that are exempt or work in other professions and stuff currently work 7 or more days together at times. And this one group has this in place, but there are exemptions in the current law for, like, folks that work in a dairy and maintenance people, and I'm not sure why those exemptions were put in there, but they're in the current law. And there's also the ability for a factory or mercantile establishment to apply for an exemption with the Department of Workforce Development. So there already are factories, for example, that apply and get this exemption and have employees that then volunteer to work. So what we're doing in this bill is just simply taking something that already occurs when you apply for that exemption and just making it the law so that it provides that opportunity for employees, if they want to work and the employer has the work, that they can go ahead and work and earn that overtime. And then the employer, of course, gets their product taken care of. So it's kind of a win-win for everybody, I think.
Now, you talked about this applying to manufacturing and mercantiles. You're essentially talking about retail workers and manufacturing. Why specifically to those groups of employees?
I don't know why the law is crafted that way, but that's the way the current statute is, that it applies to them. And so we're just simply taking current statute and saying that we don't think this should be something that isn't allowed anymore in Wisconsin. We think it should be allowed when everybody agrees that they want to do it. So we're changing it to make it voluntary so that employees and employers can work together to benefit. I think it benefit everybody. Give the employees a chance to earn some more money and give the employers a chance to get their production done.
Now, is this, as it's drafted, entirely voluntary, or is it possible, as some critics fear, that companies could schedule employees to work 7 straight days without their input, or at least that there might be some undue pressure on them to do so?
Yeah, it's definitely drafted as it's clearly voluntary. Now, I mean, is there going to be a bad apple or an employer that might, you know, try to break the law? I mean, I'm sure that's possible, but that's why we have laws in place to address those things. There are already laws, parts of this statute, that allow if a company violates this workforce statute that this is part of, there's already ways that you can file complaints through the Department of Workforce Development. There's forfeitures for companies that violate these things, and none of that is changing. So the very same system that's currently in place for any sort of labor law violation, including things to the level of filing a claim with the Equal Rights Division for discrimination or retaliation or harassment or any of those things that currently rule in Wisconsin, would the same in this circumstance. This is changing none of that.
Does this, do you think, have the potential to give a workplace advantage to younger workers who maybe don't have families over employees who do have families to spend time with?
Well, I think people, you know, it's their choice of, you know, if they have other things that they wish to do or if they want to earn the money, you know, that's a choice you make, but that's no different than any choice that anybody makes. I think about the choices that I made and during my working years, and there were times where I was working 2 or 3 jobs and working those extra hours and working many days in a row with different employers because, you know, I wanted that funding or I had the time because I didn't have the family or whatever the case is. But these are individual choices, and that's kind of the point of the law, is that it's voluntary. And so if they want to, you know, pursue a different interest, I mean, it doesn't have to be family like you suggested. Maybe they just want to have a different social life or something as opposed to working for the money. Those are individual choices, and it doesn't change anything in this law. It's simply voluntary.
Now, as you know, the economy is coming out of a rough patch, that's putting it mildly, and jobs are competitive. The job market is tight right now. Is this something that will put pressure on employees to keep pace with the person who can more easily work 7 days, maybe out of fear that nothing explicitly would be said, but they might find that their job is eliminated or there are other reprisals or they're passed over for, you know, a move up? Is there something like that that could, this may be inherently dangerous in this law?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's, anything is possible, I guess. But when you look at the reality of this, you know, when I talk to local businesses, not necessarily on this law specifically, but on in general, like last summer or the summer before that on the campaign trail, they're looking for employees. They're looking to keep their employees and not have them recruited by other places because there's a lot that goes into training and stuff. So I just don't, my experience with employers is they're not looking to get rid of people. They're looking to keep people and be productive with them. And so I just don't think that that's a common theme that you would get from businesses.
Now, you've said that this bill would align Wisconsin law with federal laws, and that was part of its appeal for you and Senator Grothman. But isn't part of the conservative political logic to allow states to sort of figure out what works best for themselves?
Well, sure it is sometimes, but sometimes you're giving your businesses or your families in Wisconsin an unfair advantage when your tax policy or your regulatory policy is out of whack with what's going on in neighboring states. And so that's what, you know, some of the focus is. I mean, obviously, if we looked at federal law that we didn't think was good for Wisconsin, we wouldn't do it. But when we look at examples like this, where other states are operating this way and it's good for business, then, you know, why wouldn't we follow, you know, try to do that?
We're speaking right now with Wisconsin State Representative Mark Bourne from Beaver Dam. He is the co-author of a new bill that would create a voluntary 7-day work week in Wisconsin.
We'll pick up the conversation after the news, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on this new bill. If you're an employee in, say, manufacturing or retail, do you wish you did have the option to work a 7-day work week, build up some overtime, make some more money? Would you like this change? Or are you worried that it would put some kind of pressure on you and your coworkers? Call in at 800-642-1234. Or if you have a question about how the law works, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking now with Wisconsin State Representative Mark Bourne from Beaver Dam. He is the co-author of a new bill that would create a voluntary 7-day work week in Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear what you think of his idea. Would you like the option to work a 7-day week? Or do you think state laws should ensure at least a day off per week, as they currently do for people in the manufacturing or retail lines of work? If you're an employer, what do you think of this idea? Call in 800-642-1234 or share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Representative Bourne, I wonder if you could tell us about the support the bill has gotten so far, both from legislators and from people in the manufacturing and retail industries.
Well, we just started circulating the bill here, I think, a week and a half ago. Had some, you know, good interest from some of my colleagues. I haven't really talked to too many people outside until today, this weekend. It kind of started to get some media coverage and stuff. So just, you know, running into a few people today, out taking some meetings and stuff. It's been positive so far in the local manufacturing area, and I think people appreciate that it's an opportunity, like I said, for both sides to work together, a voluntary thing for the employee. And I think another thing that's important is, as I mentioned, you know, currently this occurs in some places that apply for the waiver with workforce development, and we just don't have examples that we've been able to find, at least, of employers coercing, or whatever you want to call it, employees to work. So, it may be a small sampling, but it currently occurs and works just fine, so I don't see any reason that, you know, we couldn't expand it to manufacturers throughout the state and assume that they're going to continue to work well together.
I want to go to the phones now. Let's take Bill first in Sun Prairie. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I just want to say there is definitely an element of coercion. I know that if you don't, I worked a job, and if you didn't take, the extra shifts, then you wouldn't get assigned the better tables where you had better opportunity for tips. And, the federal law isn't always the best, because I work a Monday through Friday job, or it was a Monday through Friday job now, and now they're telling us we have to work on Saturday, but they're not giving us a day off during the week. So if you want a day off during the week, you have to work half a day and then take the other half a day in leave time if you want the day off to make up for the Saturday that you have to work now. So federal law isn't always the best either.
Bill, I want to thank you for calling. And Representative Bourne, what would you say to that? Bill saying there is coercion there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the first part of his example was waiting tables, because that's specifically one of the things, working in a restaurant, that's currently exempt in the current law. So you can work 7 days without any restrictions there. And that's kind of a good example of how this is so confusing for folks, when you got to kind of get into the details of the legislation and what it's doing, because like I mentioned at the beginning, this is just for a specific part of our employees in Wisconsin. And the overall part of that is, of course, as we mentioned, the factory and retail type workers. But then there's 6-7 exemptions already in law here, as well as the ability to apply for an exemption, like some factories have done. So there's a lot of folks that this doesn't apply to and wouldn't apply to. And so, to, you know, it's that's where there's just a lot of confusion with that.
All right. Well, I want to thank for that call. And let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, yeah. I worked a factory job, and I worked, I don't know, for 6 months, 12 hours a day, and I loved it. But then the pay wouldn't go up, and your job title wouldn't go up. And now I'm working another place where, you know, you only work so many hours, and that's it. You go home, or you don't get paid. And I think it'd be great if they bring it back, but I don't think Milwaukee's going to do it because there's too much money. We have to start paying overtime and double time for a Sunday. Companies aren't doing it. The economy isn't here for it.
So, John, sounds like you liked it because you saw it resulted in opportunities for advancement.
It would. It should. But I don't see companies doing it because it's not in the beginning. It's going to hurt too much money in the beginning, and they're not going to be able to make it up as far as they may see it in the end.
Okay, John, thanks. And Representative Bourne, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think it's right as far as that some companies won't want to do it, but it certainly isn't anything a company needs to do. I think it's more when companies have some seasonal work and stuff where they need to get some things accomplished, they do some short-term extra overtime, and it's cheaper for them to pay overtime or even double time, as some factories do, as he mentioned, on a Sunday, than to hire additional employees just for a short-term project or something. So it's all depends on the particular business and what particular time, what's going on.
I have a comment here on Facebook I want to share. Christopher says, I'm a conservative through and through, and I believe Sunday should be reserved for family and God. If you don't believe in God, then just family. What about the idea of a day of rest?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what people should do if they want to. I certainly try to do it when I can, but like I mentioned, there were times in my life, and even times now with this job, where I don't take days off because there's things that need to be done. And so, yeah, it's you know, entirely up to individuals, and days of rest are good. You should get them in when you can, and that's why this is all voluntary, that people can choose what's best for them and their situations and their families.
Now, I want to ask you about something Senator Grothman said in response to Democrats' opposition to this bill. Senator Grothman said, it's ridiculous when people want to work extra hours, why Democrats would stand in the way of that. I don't know why some people want some people to remain poor. A counterargument to that from Democrats might be to make sure that employees can earn enough in 6 days to support themselves instead of having to work those extra hours, which might involve raising the minimum wage. Now, what would you say to that?
Well, I think that there's different opportunities out there all over the place, and I think that people have to decide what, you know, opportunities are best for them and situations are best for them. And there are certainly jobs that allow people to earn what they feel is necessary in sometimes only a couple of days of work, and others we work more days, and so it's all individual situations.
And back to the phone lines we go. Let's go to Barbara, who's joining us next from Eau Claire. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I can certainly see why this would be attractive to employers. My concern, though, is that this allows them to reduce their workforce because they can have the same number of employees cover more shifts. And ultimately, it's going to be bad for employees because they, whether they are coerced or they simply feel pressured to work those additional shifts or those additional days, they're going to need to remain competitive in a time when job creation should be our number one priority, and yet we're passing or we're proposing bills like this that allow employees to reduce their workforce. Your guest makes it seem like there are all these jobs out there that people can choose whether they want to make their family their first priority or working overtime their first priority. And we really should not be forcing people to make that type of a decision.
Okay, thank you for that call, Barbara. And Representative Bourne, do you think this will actually cut down on the number of people who are employed?
Yeah, I think that's unlikely just because there's not enough hours, you know, in one day to make a major impact in your total work production that's needed for a 5 or 6 day normal production. I think this is something that's utilized a lot more seasonally or in term when particular job increases that are short term, things like that. And those are things that even if we wished it so, aren't going to create new jobs. And you know, we continue to focus on things in Wisconsin to try to grow our economy and bring jobs. And you know, this is just one of many pieces of legislation that are being worked on.
How optimistic are you that this will pass, and do you expect Governor Walker to sign it?
We haven't. I certainly haven't heard anything from the administration on this in particular, but I also haven't really heard any opposition from when we did some research with the department and things. There wasn't any opposition from them. We haven't asked them specifically for up or down on the bill, but I think it's got a decent chance of moving forward. I think that it works with both sides together, and I mean, obviously, I've seen some of the comments from Democrats and laborers wanting to make this sound a lot more terrible than it possibly is, and something that's so straightforward and something that operates so effectively now when exemptions are granted here in Wisconsin and effectively in states all over the country. So I think there's a good chance it'll move forward.
Representative Born, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Wisconsin State Representative Mark Born from Beaver Dam, talking about a new proposed legislation that would create a voluntary 7-day work week in Wisconsin.
You can keep the conversation going on our Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Next is Wisconsin Life with a look at what it means to be Midwestern. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, it's the 50th anniversary of the federal government's campaign against smoking. We'll find out how far we've come in the last half century.
And first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. The South, New York, New England, they all conjure images and characteristics. We kind of know what we're talking about when we talk about those regions. But what does it mean to be Midwestern? We want to hear from you on this. What do you think it means to be a Midwesterner? Is there a distinctively Midwestern culture or personality? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org.
We'll hear from you in just a minute, but first, writer John Hildebrand reflects on the values and ideas he associates with the Midwest.
I was looking for another chair. Three of us had snagged a table in the hotel bar, all chrome and mirrors, but came up a chair short. So I shoehorned through the crowd, PhDs in dark suits and little black dresses, drinking flavored vodka and looking smart, as would I, once I had a place to sit. Finally, I located an empty chair at a crowded table and asked if I might take it. Half a dozen faces looked up as if I was a sentence that needed deconstructing. Then a small bearded man at the end of the table spoke. "You're from the Midwest, aren't you?" When I asked how he knew, the man smiled. "Because you asked." I bore the chair away, feeling somehow diminished. No longer a man of the world, but one more bumpkin fallen off the turnip truck, my suit suddenly flecked with hay. Sometimes I get tired of Midwest nice. No, I get tired of other people's assumptions about the Midwest. Sometimes I wish Garrison Keillor and the whole humble population of Lake Wobegon would set up shop on Long Island. Let some other place be the land that time forgot. In Hollywood, place always plays a role in the backstory. If the West is where we're going in the movies, then the Midwest is where we're from. It's Bedford Falls, or Mr. Deeds' hometown, or it's Happy Days, or That 70s Show. It's why screenwriters gave both Annie Hall and the Jack Dawson character in Titanic the same Chippewa Falls address, to signal their innocence in contrast to slicker, more worldly types. Movies aside, I don't believe geography is fate. So much of what people ascribe to the Midwest, a lack of pretense, respect for physical labor, a tendency toward understatement, are rural values. But as the farm population dwindles, do those qualities transfer to the rest of us by osmosis? I don't think so. A few years ago, I lost a friend who embodied just about every trait we associate with the Midwest. He grew up on a farm in a large family. Even after moving to a city, he loved being in the country. He loved to hunt. He was a veteran and a family man, and he spoke softly and deliberately and with an understated sense of humor that put everyone at ease. His name was Joe Bijon, and he was born in Zhongquan province in northern Laos. He didn't reach Wisconsin until his late teens, having already experienced much of the world. To call him strictly a Midwesterner, a product of our native soil, would be to flatter ourselves.
John Hildebrand teaches English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and is the author of three books, including A Northern Front.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org or check out Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
Now we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What do you think it means to be a Midwesterner? What traits and values do you associate with Wisconsin and the Midwest? And if you do travel to other parts of the country, can people immediately tell that you're from the Midwest? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll start with Nick in Green Bay. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess my opinion of being a Midwesterner is I lived here in Wisconsin. I lived in Michigan. And I flew out to Texas last year about this time. And people say I sounded like I was from Canada. And I guess it's just us being friendly here. And people in Texas couldn't believe that we had front yards. They couldn't believe the grass and the trees and stuff. It just blew their mind. They're like, you must be rich to have a yard that big. It's like, no, I told them I go five minutes away and I hit farms. And they couldn't believe it in Texas. It was just amazing to them. And it's something I take for granted here, but.
Huh.
Well, not no more anymore, but I appreciate what we have here.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Nick. So in some ways, we're America's Canadians, I guess. back to the phones now.
And we go to Atlanta in Sparta. Hi there.
Hi. I definitely agree with the last caller with sounding Canadian. I went to New Mexico and everyone thought that's where I was from.
Interesting.
But my trait, I think, is the overly polite. My sister and I both grew up here in Wisconsin, a small town, actually Mindoro. And we're known for apologizing to inanimate objects for bumping into them. So we're overly polite. We're polite to a fault.
Has that served you well, or has it been something that you're a little embarrassed about?
Sometimes it can kind of make me look like a doormat, I think.
Uh-huh.
But I think around here, that's how we all are. So to not be overly polite, you're rude.
Okay, so, interesting. Yeah. Yes, very polite. Thank you so much, Atlanta. Appreciate that call.
We'll go now to Pat in Palmyra. Pat, hi.
Hi, yes. I am a very proud Midwesterner. I feel that we're very basic people. We don't put on a lot of air. We just enjoy life, and we're honest and reliable. I think reliable is another word for us. I have traveled around the country. I've tried living in other parts of the country, and I had to come back just to be with the real people. Real basic people. That's the way I feel about Midwesterners.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Pat. Appreciate your call. You can join in. We're talking about what it means to be a Midwesterner. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Veronica, a couple things I think of was I had a job for a while where I was calling for people in New York a lot and people in West Virginia a lot. And my definition of Midwesterner is people who talk slower than people in New York and faster than people in West Virginia. Because I felt really intimidated and aggressive, you know, from the people in New York. And I think the people in West Virginia perceived that back from me.
Speed of talk, something like that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I think that Midwestern values are, I think so much about the way that we sound. And I was struck by Pat's comment about the real basic people in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if what you think. Are Midwestern people kind of basic? And she was meaning that in a loving way, in a salt of the earth kind of way. Is that something you agree with? 800-642-1234. And I want to read a comment from Facebook. Jennifer says, I've noticed often we weigh more and dress more casually.
So, yeah.
We're definitely casual here in Central Time. Scott also says, this is another Facebook comment, being pretty nice but secretly a little judgy. That's an interesting one.
I've heard that too. We'll get back to our callers now. We've got Jeanette in Warren, Illinois. Jeanette, hi.
Hi there. I worked all over the West in like 10 different states for the National Park Service, and I was routinely made fun of by folks that I've referred to as coasters, East and West Coast people, for being an Iowa farm girl. And you have to learn to be able to give something back. But I believe in still keeping your tolerance. And that's something that I noticed with a lot of the Midwesterners versus the more urban coasters, is that we had a much greater awareness of geography for the U.S. and for the world. And I think just greater awareness of things, because we were usually a little quieter. And it's something that I have lost a little of in all of my tramping across the country. But moving back to the Midwest, it's good to be back around it again.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeanette.
And we move to Andrea in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Hi, Andrea.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
It all has to do with geography. Your past caller referred to that. You know, the Midwest work ethic is so famous, and it is my opinion that it's because we have to crunch our work into a shorter season. And when I lived in the South, I found that they did not have that sense of urgency that we do when the weather's closing in, we're going to have the first snow. And so I think that's a lot of it. And I'd also like to comment that when you said Midwesterners are where we're always from in the movies, that's usually the heroes, isn't it? Isn't it the people who, the George Baxters, or George Baileys, rather, of Bedford Falls?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful thing.
That's right. Andrea, thank you so much for calling. That's interesting there. So she's kind of blaming it on winter, and so is Kathleen on Facebook, who says, we know in the Midwest that the weather is trying to kill us 6 months of the year, so that knowledge makes us more tolerant and compassionate. So some interesting angles on winter there to think of as we're going through it right now.
Alan in Eau Claire has another idea. Alan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I find Midwesterners to be incredibly generous and neighborly. I'm from the East Coast originally.
Okay. Oh, an outside perspective. Good. So far, it's been all Midwesterners talking about how great we are. I appreciate that a person from a coast shares some of that judgment. Thanks a lot for the call, Alan. Well, still time for your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. We are Central Time on WPR. Share your thoughts on what it means to be a Midwesterner, maybe for better or worse. Oh, and speaking of the movies and TV, I remember Dave Foley from Kids in the Hall. He was the star of News Radio. He's Canadian in real life, but his character was from Wisconsin.
There it is again, the Canadian-Wisconsin theme. Well, thank you so much for all those calls. And coming up, 50 years ago this weekend, the Surgeon General issued the first report on the health hazards of smoking. We'll take a look back at 5 decades of anti-smoking efforts and find out what's still on the table in a campaign against tobacco use. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.